We create our own perceptions and reality through our mind. We create our own perceptions and reality through our mind. Our self-conditioned, repetitive, hurtful behaviors to ourselves and others are often governed by our perceptions and emotions, which are ultimately delusional and transient. It's shocking, scary, and refreshing to know that every time I open my eyes to see the world, the way I perceive my situation and reality is a reflection of my current state of mind. So in other words, the way we perceive things depends on what our state of mind is. We can see things differently depending on what our state of mind is. If it's in a state of agitation, anger, or fear, we see it one way, and if it's a state of clarity, equanimity and compassion, we can see it in a completely different way. So the state of our mind actually determines how we see reality. And this is a very, very powerful and deep, true statement. Freedom from the delusional mind is found through the practice of meditation. More importantly, whatever human virtue we are missing in our lives can be self-cultivated and rediscovered through meditation. So I interpreted this statement as really a kind of endorsement, a kind of emphasis on sort of leading more virtuous, sort of using meditation as a pathway to attain a more virtuous kind of life. So my response went something like this. I agree with you that the process of meditation does represent a process of, quote, purification, in the sense that we begin to see clearly the nature of our negative emotions and the impact they can have on causing suffering for ourselves and others. We also begin to see how diverse our reactions to situations can be according to the different conditions we are experiencing in any moment. That allows us to begin to understand how conditioned we are by circumstances, often in ways we were not even aware of. It is through the seeing of suffering and conditionality that we begin to cultivate understanding and wisdom, and ultimately acceptance and compassion. It is through that process that we start to cultivate the kind of virtuous behavior that seeks only well-being and happiness for ourselves and others. In the Buddhist teachings, there are 10 paramis, or virtues, that we seek to accomplish through the practice. They are generosity, morality, renunciation of unskillful behavior, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, or resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. So the result of the practice is that of achieving a higher standard of moral and ethical behavior, as it is expressed through the cultivation of these 10 virtues. One of the hallmarks of the practice is how it transforms us in terms of our behavior. But part of this process is, how we are actually behaviorally changed by the meditative process. So it's part of the whole complex of transformation, elements of transformation that we undergo as we change, as a result of the meditation practice. So this is a really powerful thing to understand. It's not all, sort of airy-fairy spiritual stuff. This is really nuts and bolts, personal transformation. And it has to do with literally how we behave in the world. So one of the things that, one of the reasons why I find this teaching so powerful and so important is that it really addresses fundamental issues having to do with our personal behavior, the way we actually behave in the world. and how that behavior can be a cause of suffering, or it can be a cause of wisdom, understanding, compassion, and peace. So this is really kind of where the rubber meets the road, if you will, in terms of how the transformation process works and how, you know, the meditation, mindfulness, the role that mindfulness plays, you know, in this process. I think as we go through the Dharma teachings, I think one of the things that will be absolutely clear, is that it has nothing to do with killing, it has nothing to do with lying, cheating, stealing, or any of those kinds of, you know, behaviors that lead to those results. Okay, so I mean, the bottom line is, you know, harm, you know, harm to others. You know, and we're getting into the material already, but it's ahimsa, you know, non-harming. So if there's any bottom line criteria to this whole process or this whole way of thinking, it's non-harming. As we generate, you know, as we develop more moral, ethical behavior, it stimulates the meditative process. As it stimulates the meditative process, it leads to greater understanding, wisdom, and compassion. So it's a cumulative kind of process. And so what I want to do is sort of break it out in the sense of the first three, generosity, morality, and renunciation of unskillful behavior, I regard as the sort of ethical, you know, sort of moral, ethical sort of virtues, if you will. They sort of set the foundation. Then wisdom, energy, patience, and truthfulness, and determination or resolve, numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, those are the qualities of the meditative process. You know, energy, patience, truthfulness, wisdom, you know, these are the means and the manifestation of results that one attains through the process itself. So these are more sort of process-oriented kind of virtues, if you will. And then finally, loving-kindness and compassion and equanimity are the sort of ultimate kinds of results that we attain as we go through, you know, these preliminary stages. So the first few stages have to do with morality, you know, setting the basis in terms of moral behavior. And the second group of factors have to do with the meditative process, you know, the whole process of attaining insight and wisdom. And then the third two have to do with the sort of results and the sort of capacity for attaining a true sense of compassion, loving kindness, and ultimately equanimity. Equanimity is really the goal in this practice. Equanimity is the final freedom, if you will, in the sense of it's not equanimity like indifference, you know, like you're not, you know, you don't care about what's happening. But it's equanimity in the sense of a kind of wholehearted acceptance of things as they are. Wholehearted acceptance of things as they are. So it's whether it's good or it's bad or it's cruel or it's kind, you know, life as it comes, you're just able to accept things as they are with this sense of spaciousness, a sense of acceptance, and love. And, you know, any person who can sort of exhibit those kinds of qualities, I would say, is a very spiritually sort of, you know, refined being. So this is the highest form of kind of spiritual virtue that we strive to attain, you know, in this practice. And it represents the ultimate sort of freedom, right? It's freedom from hatred, freedom from, you know, being right or wrong, or, you know, sort of kind of grasping onto standards or, you know, beliefs or certainly material things, you know, that cause a sense of separation and suffering for oneself and for others. You know, it's like this zero-sum kind of mentality. So it's beyond that sort of, you know, sense of separation and you know, zero sum kind of relationship into something larger. So the question is, you know, what is that larger sensibility, you know, and how do we attain that sensibility, you know, through the practice? Now, it starts with generosity. Well, first of all, let me just say, the reason I think that this is so powerful as the opening kind of virtue is because it really speaks to the relationship between self and other. Okay, so it's the whole concept of what it means to be a self, you know, an individual person, and how that relates to another, an other person, another, you know, whether it's a relationship with a wife and a husband or a family or friends, you know, others, self and other. It's the basic fundamental tension between self and other. Okay, so this is fundamental. Right? It comes down to when you're a kid sitting at the table eating your breakfast and you're looking at how much your sister gets and how much you get, and if you get a little bit more, you take a little bit more, you know, right? Or if you're cutting an apple, you know, how big a piece you cut for yourself and how much you cut for your brother or sister. You know, it's at that level, right? And that starts when we're like 3 years old. Self and other. How do we relate to this whole relationship between self and other? And it has to do with selfishness. It has to do with generosity. It has to do with, you know, holding back or giving. Right? Whether it's to your brother, sister, sibling, wife, husband, you know, to other people. So how do you define this relationship? To me, that's so fundamental. I mean, it really defines how we are in the world. And this is about, this is all about, this is what ethics is all about. Morality. Ethics and morality have to do with this relationship between self and other. It's not only about myself, my personal transformation, but it's how my relationships to others define my personal transformation. And my personal transformation is defined through my relationships with others. So it's really fundamental in terms of understanding who we are in this world. Now, as I was thinking about this, a couple of thoughts came to mind. Looking, for example, you know, have you ever contemplated, you know, patterns of selfishness that you've experienced in your life? I mean, what are ways in which you choose between self, or you, it's yourself that is being propitiated, being served, right? One is eating, right? I mean, the simple act of eating, you know, when you eat. Do you eat for nourishment, for sustenance, or do you eat as a form of psychological compensation? Right? And when you share food, you know, do you share on the process in the spirit of giving, or do you share in the process of, you know, proportionate distribution according to size and weight and age? You see what I'm saying? What is the mental calculus that you go through, you know, when you eat? And of course, you know, this whole thing about obesity and hyper-obesity, you know, has to do with our inability to deal with our consumption of food. And not to mention, you know, alcohol, drugs, recreational, you know, sort of things that we take as compensation, you know, for, you know, psychological mental states, you know, sort of negative mental states. And this is what drug addiction is all about, alcoholism, you know. So how do we, what is the role of our sense of self in relationship to this very, very basic function? You know, not to mention sex, procreation, clothing, how we buy things, we buy material things, you know. Do we get addicted to clothes and nice things, nice cars, nice houses, you know, the latest fashions? You know, how long do we look at ourselves in the mirror and, you know, pleased with what we see, or get or get upset with what we don't see or what we want to see. All of these patterns that play out in terms of how we deal with ourself that are mediated to through our everyday behavioral, sort of activities. Shopping, when we go shopping. Do we go shopping because we're there to get something that we need? Or do we go shopping because we're trying to compensate for, some negative mental state, like we're depressed or we're trying to forget something? So how does the self manifest? How does this whole concept of self and other manifest in terms of how we propitiate ourselves, in the market? At the food table, at the dining table, it pervades every aspect of our lives. And then, how does this change over time? As we go through teenage years, adolescent years, middle age, going into, maturity, coming into old age. And one of the things, for example, I notice very much as I age, is how we tend to feel more vulnerable. People who are older know this, right? As you get older, you feel more vulnerable. So as you feel more vulnerable, you naturally tend to be nicer to people around you, right? Because, you're worried that if something happens, you need people to help you, right? Like even if you're in the store, you're talking to a waitress or a waiter or, I find myself naturally becoming more friendly, more open and, more... But, it's based on a kind of fear. It's based on my sense that I might need some help. Because I'm not as strong, I'm not as vital, I'm not as smart, I'm not as quick as I used to be, right? So we're kind of reaching out. And, older people, right? As people get older, you depend on your children. That's why we have children. In the old days, that was the reason we had children, right? We didn't have social security in those days. We didn't have long-term care. We had kids so that they could take care of us when we got older. So this whole concept of course, when you're 21 years old, who cares? You don't care because you're the king of the world. You're all powerful. Nothing can hurt you, nothing can harm you. But that changes as you get older, more vulnerable. Also, the notion of as we get older, we tend to be more willing to help people who suffer in ways that we have suffered. Empathy and compassion start to grow because, for example, if we've had a disease like diabetes or cancer or, we've had a car accident. Or, look at the whole gun control thing, right? The Brady Bill, right? People who know the catastrophe that can happen, because of some illness or some disease or some, people's ignorance or violence and have suffered as a result of that through that natural kind of sense of compassion so that others don't have to suffer in the same way, start to reach out. So these boundaries between self and other begin to shift over time. Okay, so There are lots of ways in which this whole relationship, this whole dialectic, if you will, changes and shifts as we go through life. And this is really, really fundamental to understanding ourselves and our relationship to other people. And the ultimate clinker, as this is just the opening of the whole series, but the ultimate clinker in this whole teaching, and I say that people who have been here before know what I'm saying, in the sense I've talked about this many, many times before, is that in the Buddhist teaching, there is no self. There is no, separate individual entity which is a self. Okay, now that's, for those who aren't familiar with the teaching, it's a little bit difficult to get around, but, and we'll get into this as we move through the teaching. But if there's no self, right, then there's no other, right? It's only when there's a self that there is an other. So if somehow we can understand, at least intellectually understand, if not realize within ourselves, what this concept of no self means, then somehow this whole notion of this dialectic between self and other is fundamentally transformed. See, this is really the crux of the whole teaching, where all of a sudden, you know, this wisdom and understanding opens to compassion and loving kindness because we see the world differently. We don't see it as this individual self-aggrandizing person that I am, or self-maximizing person, but actually as one of a whole, you know, larger whole, of which we are all the same. Now, if we can truly see the world in that way, it would fundamentally alter the way we relate to other people. And so that's why I say this is a clinker, because from the very beginning, you know, Dharma teaching has been about non-self or no self. So in order to understand the Buddhist teaching on generosity and, you know, morality, you sort of have to see it from the point of view that the Buddhists are coming at, and that is that there is no self. So how do you mediate, you know, how do you mediate the relationships that we have in society, you know, in culture, you know, in our communities, in our families, in our, you know, in our peer groups, in a way, you know, that reflects this understanding, this view of the world that overcomes separation, competition, and this zero-sum kind of mentality. So this is really the kind of theme, if you will, the overarching theme of this whole discussion. What is this dynamic that informs this whole discussion about morality and ethics, you know, in the conventional sense? Okay, so I say this as a way of kind of introducing the bigger picture as we start to move through, you know, the individual elements. Now, the traditional Buddhist definition of dana, D-A-N-A, which is the Pali term for generosity. And this is all from Wikipedia, so if you wanna, you know, check me, just go to Wikipedia. The reason I chose it too is because it is so general and it's so easily accessible. So, you know, and as I read the definitions, yeah, they're pretty accurate. So, you know, they're really good definitions to use in a very simple presentation. Okay, so dana means generosity in the form of alms, in the giving of alms. That's traditionally the meaning of it. It's the practice of cultivating generosity. And it can be characterized as unattached and unconditional generosity, giving and letting go. Generosity developed, and this is a very interesting statement, and I'm going to try to see if I can expand upon this a little bit, because this is really, I think, very, at first it's hard to understand, but I think as you understand the teachings more deeply, it kind of blossoms, you know, into awareness. Generosity developed through giving leads to being reborn in happy states and the availability of material wealth. Conversely, lack of giving leads to unhappy states and poverty. Okay, this is a pretty counterintuitive statement, right? It's like, if you don't give, you know, you will experience unhappiness and poverty. If you give, you will experience happiness and material wealth. I mean, that's, you know, it's like a contradiction in terms. So you give and you become wealthy, and you hold back and you become poor. And this is, you know, so this is straight out Wikipedia, right? So what the heck does this mean, right? So I'm kind of setting this up as the premise, you know, for the discussion. Now, as I was researching this topic, I came across a very interesting article, and the title of the article was Are you emotionally generous? I'm not going to read the whole article, but there's just a couple of points that stood out for me because I think they really clearly describe what it means to not be generous and how it so vividly describes a lot of my personality. So I had to, when I read this, I thought, whoa, and I had to think twice. But I recommend you to think about this in terms of your own life too, in terms of, you know, how does this describe you? Anyway, so it starts off with, do you praise other people often? Do you praise other people at all? Are you more inclined to see people for their positive traits, or are you constantly harping on their flaws? Do you give to others without expecting anything in return? Do you seek to bring happiness and joy to others around you, or are you just focused on making yourself happy? So, what are the characteristics of emotional generosity? The act of giving positive emotions to others without expecting anything in return. Emotionally generous people continuously bring happiness, love, and positivity to others without expecting anything in return. They're constantly thinking about how they can make others around them feel better. They love praising others, rewarding people, recognizing the talents in others, showing signs of appreciation and gratitude, among other positive emotion-inducing actions. So what are emotionally stingy people? Emotionally stingy people have a very meager and miserly mindset towards sharing and giving. They are reluctant to praise other people, often sizing others up to certain expectations before they're willing to express their approval of them. They are judgmental and critical of what others say, feel, think, and act. They are selfish in sharing what they have. They would rather keep things for their own. Okay, so where do you stand on this scale? You know, I just say this kind of rhetorically, and I'm sure as you hear these words, you're kind of thinking, okay, where am I here? You know? And then there's this amazing list of emotional characteristics of emotional stinginess. Now, this is a great list, actually. Okay, number one is avoidance. Seeing other people happy makes them feel insecure and reminds them that they're not happy. So, you know, you feel insecure, right? Somebody else is happy, and say, how come I'm not happy, right? It's like, so you feel this sense of insecurity. Misery. They're miserable on the inside and want people to be like them. After all, misery loves company. Okay, so if you're unhappy and you're anxious or fearful or miserable, you know, tendencies, it'll probably affect, you know, how you behave. Self-righteousness. They feel people do not deserve to receive any act of kindness from them until he or she really proves their worth or earns it. People have to earn your praise. Right? So there's this judgmental self-righteousness. Selfishness. They don't want others to experience what they have earned for themselves. It's like the bootstraps mentality, right? I pulled myself up, you know, you pulled yourself up. I don't have to help you. I help you. And it's almost as if that becomes a principle, right? It's this principle of self-reliance, right? I am self-reliant, so you have to be self-reliant, and I don't have to help you because I want you to be self-reliant. How many times have you heard that? And your parents, this is a favorite line of parents, you know, for their kids, right? I want you to be self-reliant, so you do it yourself. And, you know, and just like cross your hands and, you know, let the poor kid, you know, like, you know, wallow. And, you know, suffer. Ego. Praising someone means acknowledging that he or she is a superior and admitting that they're worse than him or her. So it's almost admitting that, you know, this person is better than I am. That already means that, you know, you're thinking in terms of better or worse, higher or lower, you know, this separation kind of duality kind of mentality. competitiveness. They see other people as a source of competition and don't want to share what they have with their competitors. Now, I think in the American culture, this is very, very common, right? I mean, in the workplace, in the family, they're always competing for resources, right? For food or for praise or for, you know, positions, you know. There's always this, you know, jostling going on. Fear. Offering an act of kindness to someone opens them up and makes them vulnerable. They are afraid of being humiliated if the kindness is not returned. This is really getting caught up in expectations, right? If I do something good, and if that person doesn't respond, boy, you're in trouble, you know, because you're just going to get angry, you're going to get, you know, frustrated. Somehow you're not acknowledged. So it's this, you know, fear of not being acknowledged. And, you know, these are all characteristics that are bound up in this sense of ego, right, this sense of separate self. And the last one is zero-sum mentality, a.k.a. the sum of all gains in a situation are equal to the losses. So if I gain something, you lose something. Everything comes up to a zero sum. So if they share what they have with others, it means they will have less for themselves. Or if I share with others, I'll have less for myself. So, you know, it's this sense of giving away, you know, what you feel is rightfully yours, you know, to someone else. You know, people, the problem with this, of course, is that people are viewed as separate entities, and it's called a sort of a duality mindset, you know, it's a duality in the sense of self and other, right? I'm here and you're there, and, you know, the whole process is about pleasing me, you know, at the cost of, in opposition to pleasing you. So there's a competitive, you know, dual sort of dynamic involved. So it's this basically zero-sum, you know, mentality. Ego drives our action. It is all about winning and beating the competition. I think the issue, the core kind of question that I have about this whole discussion is this counterintuitive sense of why is it that when you give, you get, and you don't give, and it's taken away, right? I mean, that's, so I'm trying to understand that in terms of, I mean, just seriously, I'm just trying to understand it. What does that mean? Obviously, it's stated as something that's very true, you know, in the Buddhist context. And so I was giving some thought to why that's true. Why does generosity lead to wealth and stinginess lead to poverty? Because you would think it'd be just the other way around, right? You know, a person who's stingy, saves and keeps all their stuff, gets rich, and the person who gives everything away, you know, is stupid, right? that's you know, the conventional sort of knowledge would say, you know. So why is it not true? But a kind of hint came in this article about emotional generosity. And this person describes, you know, his experience meeting emotionally stingy people and emotionally generous people, and then he gets to the point where he learns how to be emotionally generous, and he describes this interaction, and he says zero-sum theory does not seem to apply. Whenever I instill happiness and joy in others, I am given the gift of more happiness and joy myself. I am genuinely happy whenever I saw a fellow being in a better place. People would also more often than not respond in kind when you give happy, when you are generous. When you give, people respond and they give back. So there's a sense of reciprocity, right? So, and if you show compassion and show caring, people understand that you're showing this compassion, showing this caring, they give back to you. They extend back to you what you give to them. So it's a kind of karmic effect, you know, karma, in the sense that, you know, what you give comes back to you. And so, sort of see that in a larger context. Eventually, you know, material wealth can come back to you. The positive things that you give out come back to you. Like, for example, generosity. You know, as I was saying this, you know, Les Miserables comes to mind, right? The play Les Miserables, right? It was the act of generosity, you know, of the priest, you know, to Jean Valjean, right? That changed Jean Valjean forever. And then he became the benefactor, you know, the protector of, although up to that point he was just a common thief, right? So that's the transformative act of generosity, right? So, you know, if he was an upstanding member of the church, he would probably donate lots of money to the church, right? So, you know, so there was a, but it was an act of pure charity, pure generosity that produced a good karmic result, right? Because Jean Valjean himself, you know, was transformed by that whole, you know, process. So it's in that sense that we generate positive karma by our positive actions. So that's sort of one way of, you know, sort of understanding this. Now, there are a couple of, as I was thinking about it, certain other things came to mind, which I just want to share. I don't want to get into too much detail, but I think they're very provocative ideas. And, well, first of all, the first one is karma, you know, the sense of what you give, you get. So if you put out generosity, love, and compassion, you know, generosity, love, and compassion comes back to you. If you put out cruelty, violence, stinginess, self-centeredness, and ego, that's what comes back to you. Because, you know, you're creating the separation from others that becomes realized in your interaction with others. Now, as I was thinking about this, what popped into my mind was the secret. Right? It's like, yeah, this is what it's all about. So, you know, the ancient sort of teachings meld with, you know, the sort of Buddhist notion of karma in the sense of, and of course the secret is basically says that the energy that you put out is the energy that you receive. So if you're putting out energy of generosity, you know, it's like, it's a natural biological law, you know, like attracts like. So, I mean, it's sort of taught as a natural law. So if you're putting out love, and wisdom, compassion, understanding, somehow that energy attracts like energy. So what you put out is what comes back. If you put out, you know, self-centeredness, competition, you know, selfishness, that's what comes back. Because that's the energy that you're manifesting in the world. So that's the energy that you attract. So even though you might not think you're being selfish or competitive or, you know, zero-sum, you have this dual mindset, that's what's actually happening. So you can't, you know, this author was saying he couldn't figure out why. He thought he was being generous, but actually he wasn't. He was actually being very stingy. So he was attracting all this negative energy back to him, and he couldn't figure out why this was happening until he began to realize that this was the energy he was putting out. And by putting out that energy, he was alienating people around him, creating separation, creating, you know, competition, and, you know, the sense of entitlement, you know, from one against the other. Then there are a couple of other things that I'm just going to mention sort of in passing, which I thought was very, very interesting. And this other one was an idea that came to me when I was watching a David Attenborough film on nature. And he was reading this quotation from a book called The Selfish Gene. The Selfish Gene, G-E-N-E. And what he was referring to was a book on evolution that was written by Richard Dawkins in 1976. And it's basically a kind of development of Darwin's law of natural selection. Now, the gene-centered view, and basically, this was the first initial sort of landmark book that put out this whole notion of the role of genes, genetic structure in determining human behavior. So the gene-centered view follows that the more two individuals are genetically related, you know, within the same species, it makes for them to behave selflessly with each other. So there's a tendency to behave altruistically. Therefore, the concept is especially good at explaining many forms of altruism, regardless of a common nuisance. So we behave altruistically to other people because they're the same species as we are. There's a genetic kind of commonality that we share. The primary example is people who sacrifice themselves for their children or for younger people, so that genetically the gene pool is preserved, and so the individual is not so important relative to the survival of the species, which is the larger group. So altruistic behavior in that sense can be explained in terms of genetic survival. So this view explains altruism at the individual level in nature, especially in kinship relationships, when an individual sacrifices his own life to protect the lives of kin. Now, I think you can take that, of course, we all understand that very clearly in terms of like a mother to the child, how a mother, will give her life to save her child, or a father. But we can also sort of understand this in terms of other kin relationships. Well, one obvious one is the military, right? People who are in war. And, oftentimes, as you said, in the military, the unit is fighting, and, the sense of brotherly, fraternal love that they have for each other is so strong that, it's not about winning, it's about saving your brothers, and you will, sacrifice your life for, for your comrades. Even patriotism, we talk about dying for our country, right? So there are ways in which these sense of this relationship allow us to go beyond the sort of Darwinistic presumption that it's only the survival of the fittest, the individual who's strongest survives and everybody, dies away. But there are actually reasons, biological reasons, for the individual actually sacrificing himself for the larger good. So this is explained through this genetic theory. So there are biological reasons why we can be selfless, we can be altruistic. Yeah. And I think that's why people who sacrifice their lives are heroes, in the sense that they're, because they choose to sacrifice themselves for a larger group. Yeah. So that's a, that's a very powerful testament to, the human spirit. That an individual would choose, actually, to sacrifice himself for the larger group. And every time, of course, that's what makes us all feel wonderful when we hear about that kind of behavior. This is truly heroic behavior. But I think the whole point here is how does that heroic behavior become more commonplace so that for each of us, we can have this same sense of interconnectedness, the same sense of, loyalty, connection to the group, where it is more instinctive rather than a matter of choice. So, and this is really the whole nux of the Buddhist teaching, which is really, what I'm going to get to later. Yeah. But I just wanted to sort of go through these interesting ideas in terms of genetic theory, and that challenge the notion that that it's a zero-sum game. Because we're generally conditioned to think that it is a zero-sum game. What I get, what I gain, you lose, or what I lose, you gain, right? So we're in competition with others, and it's based on this presumption of, separation, right? But what we're beginning to see is that there's research, both in genetics and biology, and what I'm going to mention is evolutionary psychology, that is beginning to tell us otherwise, that there is a relationship between the individual and the group which influences our behavior in ways that we're beginning to learn. But the general conditioning that we have, particularly in this consumer-oriented, materialistic, you know, private enterprise kind of a system that we live in tends to emphasize, you know, as opposed to if we're living in a more socialist, more, you know, communally oriented kind of a system of government, you know, maybe there'd be more recognition of this relationship to helping others, right? But in this society, it's very self-oriented. So we're conditioned to see the world in more Darwinistic terms. So this is why this new information is I think, very interesting and very relevant. The other is this role of the impact of what is emerging as what is called evolutionary psychology. And this is a new field that's been coming up in the last 30 to 40 years. And evolutionary psychology is an approach in the social and natural sciences that examines psychological traits such as memory, perception, and language from a modern evolutionary perspective. And it seeks to identify which human psychological traits are evolved adaptations. In other words, certain traits have evolved through time. And this touches to that, you know, choice genetic, you know, kind of interface. Evolutionary psychologists hold that behaviors or traits that occur universally in all cultures are good candidates for evolutionary adaptation. So this happens, you know, on a cross cultural basis, including the abilities to infer others' emotions, you know, reading others' emotions. Certainly in terms of mate selection, you know, because, you know, you choose desirable females, desirable males. And decisions to cooperate and to perform altruistic acts. They report successful tests and related to marriage patterns, parental investment in children, and group loyalties. So this is a whole field of study that examines how the individual relationship to the whole, the group, evolves as a process of natural selection. In other words, this contributes to the welfare of the group. You know, so these patterns are replicated, you know, through adaptation and through heredity. So they become part of the group psychology. The point here being that it's not all about, you know, the strong beating upon the weak, but it's about how patterns of cooperation, altruism, and sacrifice, it's similar to the gene therapy, gene theory, reinforce the welfare of the larger group and so become institutionalized, you know, in the group psychology. So the point here is that there are patterns of collaborative, cooperative, and altruistic behavior that do go beyond just the individual self, and that we, you know, we do operate in ways that do exhibit altruism, compassion, understanding, and love, and that this is being, you know, sort of described in terms of natural science. Okay, so some of the characteristics that evolutionary psychology studies are altruism, the role of extended families and kinship groups, you know, how individuals fit into kinship groups, friendships, how friendships evolve and the structure of friendships, and political alliances, you know, how we make choices with regard to how we ally with people to achieve, you know, common goals. So the whole idea here is that it's not only about the individual person, and that there are dimensions in which social cooperation, social collaboration, and altruistic behavior, there's a payoff, and that it works. So, you know, for the larger group, and certainly for families, and, you know, for the larger group. And so if we can start to sort of change our kind of zero-sum attitude toward self and other, it can begin to sort of, you know, change the way we actually behave. Now, and then sort of along the line of what Richard was suggesting, that meditation is a powerful vehicle for understanding this whole process, you know, as it unfolds within us, and understanding it in several ways. I mean, what Richard mentioned was the very direct sort of sense of emotional satisfaction that you have, you know, when you exercise generosity, when you exercise compassion for someone, to see the result of it and the benefit of it that the person, you know, sort of experiences. And also to sense the sense of contraction, as you say, when you're not, when you're selfish, when you withhold, you know, generosity from someone else. But it's also a way of sort of seeing a larger picture, if you will. When you look at decisions that you make with respect to sharing, with respect to generosity, dana, in the sense of giving of alms, in the sense of, you know, for the practice, for the temple, or for others, like, you know, like even giving donations to charitable institutions. I mean, we all, you know, we all have our charitable institutions that we give. So the whole notion of giving really, it allows us to look at the consequences of our actions, you know, whether they, in the long run, they lead us into a more generous, more open, compassionate roles, or in the end, does it lead more to isolation and separation and a sense of sort of depression, you know, kind of an enclosement rather than a sense of opening to relationships and people around us. So this is a really important kind of practice because it's not about giving and getting. I mean, it is about giving and getting, but it's about what the emotional, psychological, and sort of long-term implications of this whole process is for us. So, and this is where, you know, meditation can have a very powerful effect in terms of allowing us to get a better sense and understanding.